Hello, please let me see your ticket stubs for the double-edged double bill. This week, Adventure leads our master and commander into the Sahara. Adam Thomas and Thomas Mariani will come to the table to discuss the randomly selected yin and yang of a double feature. Then both will have to pick a number between 1 and 10 in order to seal their fates for the next episode. One will have two good movies, the other two bad ones. Let the chaos begin. I am Adam Thomas, and I've never seen an iguana before.
And I'm Thomas Mariani, and I'm so glad to have my sidekick back so we can go on yet another adventure as we do every week. Isn't every week an adventure, Adam?
I guess adventures don't always have to be fun.
Nope, and that's what we guarantee. It won't always be fun. But
yeah,
Adam and I are not the only ones here because we have a guest with us here. She is a staff writer and an editor over at FilmCred. It is Miss Hale Peralta. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
We decided to invite you on because I knew you had an interest in podcasting to some degree, and you decided, out of all the topics, you wanted to do this week's topic, which we're doing in honor of Uncharted, I guess, coming out. I still don't believe it. No matter how many times I see Tom Holland fall out of things, I very much doubt that movie still exists.
Do you even want it to, though? Like, isn't that a better question?
I mean, I don't think anyone's really wanted to, but it's happening, I guess.
I think Uncharted is one of those movies, like, you know, you walk in and it's like a publisher's clearhouse where they give you like a check and they're just like, we're just amazed that you even bought a ticket. Like, here's $300. Please go and enjoy the rest of your day.
The ghost of Ed McMahon gives you a giant check.
Yes! Oh, it's cold where I am.
But, you know, we're doing adventure films. And why adventure? Out of curiosity.
Mostly two things. One, a lot of the other topics I was interested in, I was unfortunately out of the country, so I wasn't going to be able to have my podcast set up, and I really wanted to get on and talk with you guys. So adventure was like the furthest day out, and I was like, yes, I'm like set up in February, fine. But also, and I've talked about it on Twitter sometimes, where it's like the fact that I am the child of immigrant parents to the United States means that like my nostalgia for American pop culture doesn't necessarily line up with a lot of like my contemporaries in my generation. So I don't have that attachment to like the Indiana Joneses and things like that. So adventure is kind of a bit of a blind spot for me. So I wanted to kind of take advantage and like sort of do some research and kind of like probe some things I had never really seen before.
Yeah, adventure is a weird subgenre because, you know, Adam and I kind of came across doing this because the Uncharted thing lined up. We were like, oh, of course, it makes perfect sense to do it. We've never done that somehow in our long history with the show. And then really doing research, it's weird to think of, like, it's become sort of like a lost genre because it's become so much more compact with like, oh, it's like one slice of your average blockbuster now, and the ones that are more overtly adventure at this point are just kind of ripping off like a Pirates of the Caribbean. Like, remember last summer's Jungle Cruise and how much we all loved it? Remember? We were all just swept up in the Jungle Cruise.
Look, man, Dwayne The Rock Johnson as a Spaniard always wins. Always.
An immortal Spaniard.
An immortal Spaniard. Twist. Spoiler.
Hey, Jungle Cruise spoilers, please. My God.
Even though it was the highest grossing film and everyone loved it so much. And we had, remember all the Jungle Cruise memes that came out and how much everyone couldn't stop talking about it?
Absolutely. Jungle Cruise fever, not to be confused with malaria.
True. Right. But it's weird, especially because like it feels like just a lot of adventure movies that are trying to be more of the adventure ever since like 2003 have just been really trying to chase that Pirates of the Caribbean like money at this point. It just feels like that was such a great lightning bottle that we never would have expected would have worked. And even that series of movies has been still flailing trying to like make that work to some degree. Adam, what do you think is like the reason why adventure just doesn't work anymore?
Well, I mean, the thing is, you say it doesn't work anymore, and I'd argue it definitely does, just not in necessarily in the sense that we're thinking. Yeah, you know, adventure movies like Indiana Jones, Uncharted, things like that, you know, they're not around too much more, but I'd argue pretty much every MCU movie would be considered an action adventure film. It's just not necessarily in the way we maybe want it to be, but I think they're still probably the most successful films out there right now are adventure films, 100%.
You know what I love about an adventure is when I know the exact pinpoints of every single step of that adventure, like with an MCU movie.
I know, but you say that, but can't you argue that you could do the same with all the ones we were just talking about, too? With all the other Pirates movies, with all the with Jungle Cruise, with Our Bad Future Today, with Uncharted, just from the trailer. They all follow the same formula for the most part. It's just some really have a lot of passion and panache behind it, and others don't.
Well, it also probably helps that with a lot of those other movies, it usually isn't somebody who's, like, magical. What I kind of like about an adventure, even like Indiana Jones, where those movies do have a similar formula, there's always a bit of that danger of, like, well, he is a human being, even though he's Indiana Jones. It's just that now we have superheroes who can get out of any of these, like, horrible situations they have. So it's just kind of like, oh, it's an adventure with a big, like, immortal person. Even Jungle Cruise had that problem, where it's just like, oh, man, The Rock is, like, an actual person. No, he's, like, an immortal Spaniard dude bouncing around with Emily Blunt. It just feels like there's less of the stakes that you have even in some, like, you know, formulaic adventure movies of the past. It still feels like it's even less suspenseful than it used to be.
Funny that you guys brought up that, like, you know, Adam, you were saying that, like, MCU films could be considered adventure, because when I was doing some Googling, just because I had a moment where I blanked out, where I was kind of like, what does that necessarily mean? Even most of the top results that were showing up just on the Google algorithm were just every single MCU film. And I was kind of just like, it both does and doesn't. Because for me, like, adventure was always very, like, and my biggest frame of reference is, like, the stuff that's directly mostly kind of ripping it off. So, like, Atlantis, Treasure Planet, like, all these, like, Disney, we really want boys to watch our movies type things, where it's very globe-trotty, usually kind of, like, messy and dirty and grimy. And the MCU is kind of, like, the most clean and neat version of it, where something that I enjoyed so much about the good film that we had to watch was, you know, an adventure is nasty. It's kind of like what you guys are talking about, where it's like, you know, Indy is just a normal person and he could get hurt or killed even. And those for me are like what makes it fun. It's not just sort of like the, you know, it's a treasure hunt, but it's also like a dangerous treasure hunt, which I think is what makes it fun, which is where I feel the MCU kind of lacks, because we know these people are locked into multi-picture deals and they're not going to die. But, you know, the best ones are, I think, the ones that play with that sense of danger.
Yeah, down to, like, at this point now, that is so rare to get one of those type of movies, to where I've been seeing this trailer for The Lost City, the one with Sandra Bullock and Channing Tatum, and I don't have much interest in that movie, but at the same time, I hope that makes hundreds of millions of dollars so we get more of those movies.
That's not gonna happen.
Nope, probably not, because people are gonna be seeing Spider-Man for the 55th time, Adam, that's why.
Yep. Oh, boy.
Right. Let's go ahead and get into our movies then, because if you're new, at the end of every episode, Adam and I randomly pick a good and a bad feature that we discuss on the next episode. So last week, we randomly did our picking, and we ended up getting our bad feature, Sahara, which was one of Adam's choices, and then the good pick, which is one of my choices, of Master and Commander, The Far Side of the World. But let's get our bad feature out of the way first with Sahara.
For years, I've wondered if the stories were true. And now, I finally have the proof.
You found a coin.
I found the coin. At the end of the Civil War, a battleship carrying a secret shipment of gold vanished without a trace.
Where in the hell did you get this?
From the Niger River.
In Africa.
You got 72 hours.
I'll meet you at the boat.
Nope. I got the check. Sit down, I'll get the check.
For explorer Dirk Pitt and his team.
This is the place. The ship should be here.
The mystery that's buried with a long-forgotten legend carries a threat.
This thing could kill millions.
No one could have imagined.
Safina du Al-Maut.
That sounds poetic. What's it mean?
The ship of death.
Great!
From international best-selling author Clive Cussler, Sahara.
Hey! Where are we going?
How about now? But we're making great time!
So Sahara came out April 8th, 2005, and is apparently based on a bunch of books by Clive Cussler, with this Dirk Pitt character, as played here by Matthew McConaughey. And this one I hadn't seen before, and was rather infamous, I guess, for being one of the huger box office bombs of its era, where it was supposed to have like an $80 million budget, and then that ballooned out to like $160 million, and then it didn't do very well at all. Maybe arguably kind of started the destruction of the type of adventure movie we were talking about. It just isn't around anymore, because this was such a big flop. But Adam, this was your choice. And had you seen this before? And
no, I'd never seen it. I knew it by reputation only. Knew it was a big flop. Knew it was, just sort of notoriously formulaic. And I'm going to go ahead and say that is all very true. No, I did not like this movie. I found this movie very, very boring. And it got to the point to where I'm watching it, I'm like, wait, what is the point of any of this now? Like, is it about a boat? Is it about a disease? Is it about the water? What is happening? And that was pretty much how I felt up until the end. And then, this movie sucks.
Well, I mean, maybe it's appropriate for the bad pick, but let's see if our guest disagrees. Had you seen this before? And what'd you think of it?
I had never heard of this, mainly because my ultimate goal in life is to just forget Matthew McConaughey exists on any sort of spectrum or physical realm. Like, he's like my sleep paralysis demon. I find him very unpleasant to look at. And so when I started watching this, there was a slight moment of elation when, and I don't know this individual's name, but he plays the Merovingian in the Matrix movies. When he showed up as like this rich, like smarmy businessman, I was like, yes. And that was the only speck of enjoyment that I had. The rest of it, as Adam said, like, I was bored out of my mind. And it was one of those movies where I had to have Wikipedia on standby. Because again, I was just like, wait a minute, babe, we started with a civil war fight and now we're in Mali. And like, there was so much like confusion. And I was just like, what is happening? Why is there a warlord? What's with the eyeballs? Is this a zombie movie? What? And then I made the mistake of going on Letterboxd after the fact. And people will not stop with like the consistent need to have this revisionist history for every movie under the sun. The amount of people on Letterboxd that will uphold this as like some classic that needs to get like reevaluated by the culture. It doesn't. It really doesn't. It's really, really bad.
No, this doesn't need to be revisited. I do think though, to give it anything, I think there could be a lot of fun here with McConaughey and Steve Zahn sort of characters. I think if they would have leaned into that and made it more of this goofy, just straight treasure hunting movie and done something with, you know, I don't even mind the silly action or the old plane as like the windsurfing thing or anything. I don't mind any of that if they would have just stuck to that. But then it's like you get a Bond villain plot thrown in the middle of this. And then it's just, I don't think this movie really has a clear vision of the type of movie it's trying to be. Is it trying to be an action comedy? Is it trying to be a serious movie? Is it trying to make some sort of political statement? Is it trying to be, like, what is this movie?
It feels kind of like a movie where it came at a weird point because, like, for the 20 years or so prior to this movie coming out, it was so much about, like, oh, we got to rip off Indiana Jones for our adventure movies. And then this is in production around the time of, like, a Pirates of the Caribbean, where it becomes like, oh, we have to kind of go into that sphere where it's a lot more big and giant. So this feels like a movie that was greenlit as an Indiana Jones ripoff, but then also mutated into kind of like a Pirates ripoff. And it's this weird aberration in the middle that doesn't know quite which angle it wants to go with. Because, especially as we get to the ending where, like, it becomes, as Adam mentioned, very Bond plotty, and there's, like, a huge set piece involving, like, the, like, solar panels and stuff like that. I'm just like, guys, this is too much. This was just, like, a guy looking for treasure. And we've gotten way far from that. I don't know what we're doing at this point.
Not to mention the weird foray into, like, African geopolitics that it decides to take, where it's like, I was just like, why? Like, the second, and the shot repeats, like, there are five different instances in this stupid movie where, like, you know, sweet angel-faced African peasants are like waving to our heroes, like, as they're running alongside a truck or something. And I'm just like, dear God. That whole scene where, like, it's Penelope Cruz and Matthew McConaughey and Steve Zahn, and they're like standing on the boat, and all of the noble tribesmen are cheering the brave white people for helping them like save the day. And I was just, it was deeply uncomfortable for absolutely no reason. Like, I don't understand. I would say like it's true where like you say that like it started as an Indiana Jones ripoff and then halfway through kind of turns into a Pirates ripoff. But the thing I thought of the most watching this was The Mummy.
Yeah.
Especially with the whole like the dynamic between the three leads they're trying to like force, where it's just like you're not Brendan Fraser and Rachel Weisz. Like you're not. And it's okay, but you need to stop pretending you are because it's sad. And now I just wish I was watching The Mummy.
No, but didn't you love the scintillating chemistry between Penelope Cruz and Matthew McConaughey?
Goodness.
Which is so odd because they were like an item while making this movie, or became an item while making this movie. And I didn't for one second. Like, nah, there might have been a few like stolen looks. You're like, ah, maybe there's something there, but it just did not translate at all. I much preferred the bromance element of it to this forced. That's one thing. Why do we got to do that? Why does that have to be in every single one of these movies, a sort of uptight love interest to, you know, let's loose because the guy's such a reckless cannon and he flies by the seat of his own pants. So through him, she learns to enjoy her career and blah, blah, blah. It's just such dumb bullshit. And yes, the white American savior shit in this movie is out of control. It is absolutely out of control. And Rainn Wilson's there too.
Right, as like the third wheel to like the bromance chemistry with like Steve Zahn and Matthew McConaughey, we're just like, do you want me to leave? Okay, I'll leave. And he literally leaves like from that group halfway through the movie, which I'm sure he left to go shoot The Office pilot, which is also really weird considering this came out like just 2 weeks after The Office premiered. So I'm sure Rainn Wilson's just like, I don't know if this NBC show's gonna like work itself out, guys, but I've still got the Sahara sequel. I'm sure gonna be involved in that, baby. That's gonna totally happen.
Oh, yeah, wasn't there planned to be, like, at least three of these?
Well, yeah, because the Dirk Pitt character has, like, been in a bunch of novels. And yeah. I'm sure they planned on, like, doing a bunch of those. But obviously, given how much the weird inflation happened with the budget, which is, like, there's so many weird things about it. Apparently, like, a dossier came out where, like, they bribed out the Moroccan government. And also, they were paying, like, Penelope Cruz's hairstylist, like, $250,000. And shit
I was
like going to
say... On Wikipedia, there was a line that got, like, no further context where it said that, like, he was accused of breaking international law. And I said, hold on a minute. What? And then I kept looking and the stuff about the lawsuit was just about, like, the inflated budget. And I'm like, can we get back to the, like, international law of it all? Can I know about that? Like,
there's a much more interesting adventure movie about the production of Sahara than Sahara itself.
Precisely. Like, I would very much watch like some weird Adam McKay movie about the production of this movie. Like, and I don't even like Adam McKay, but like, my God, it's crazy.
Yeah, it's pretty weird. But I guess to go back to the Matthew McConaughey of it all, you said you weren't a fan of Mr. McConaughey necessarily. What is exemplified maybe here that makes you just not like him as much as a star?
He has this thing where it feels like, and it was funny, I very recently watched Contact all the way through for the first time. That was a staple, like my dad fell asleep on the couch on a Sunday afternoon type of movie. So I had never actually seen the full thing. And I had the same issue there that I have here, where it's like, he carries himself as if he knows that we're supposed to think he's like hot and cool and charismatic. I don't know if that makes sense, but instead
of that's 100% accurate.
That is pretty much his appeal, honestly, to some people. Yeah,
it's not like he is suave or he is charismatic. It's that he knows that that's his. You know what I mean? Like, it's just very calculated. It's very, and it's not even in like a The Rock way, where The Rock is trying to be the most positive thing. Like, I can't, like, The Rock irritates me for similar reasons because it's very polished and very like, this is how I'm supposed to present myself. But at least The Rock is doing it with like this big gleaming smile on his face where I'm like, at least, you know, whatever. He seems like he'll give you a pat on the back and buy you a beer. And like, he seems like a good time. But Matthew McConaughey is just so smug. Yeah, sure. It's not like I believe him in any other capacity as like, you know, why wouldn't he be like some swashbuckling rogue? But I'm also just like, I just want to punch you in the face. Cause I'm like, you're not that cool. Like, you scuba dive for a living. It's not that serious.
Why can't they ever give Matthew McConaughey a decent dye job in movies? Like, right. His hair is so ridiculous, the dye line, and then the eyebrows. He's never just Matthew McConaughey, like, he's always got black hair or dark brown hair, or sometimes black hair and blonde eyebrows. Interstellar. I don't understand why. What is the point? It doesn't make him look any better. It makes it look like he's a dude, exactly what you're saying, trying to be like, look how fucking cool I am. You're like,
I think there are certain movies where that works. I think it's really in more grounded context, like, say, a Dazed and Confused, where he's also a side character, or even in, like, the McConaissance, you had him, like, popping up in, like, a Wolf of Wall Street or stuff like that, where it's like, oh, hey, I'm the coolest, like, basically the coolest redneck in the small redneck community. I'm the hottest one, to where that technically kind of works for him, and there's a bit of a sleaziness understood with that, but this is around the time when he was, like, starting to get out of whatever, like, praise he was getting for, like, his earlier appearances, like, In Contact or A Time to Kill, and was becoming full-on, like, I think this is the same year as, like, Failure to Launch, where he just goes into full-on rom-com mode, just like, everyone knows I'm cool and I get a lady, so I'm just, it's all great, it's all good, it's all great, brother. And I think, like, this is the exact period where I stopped really giving much of any attention to McConaughey, because I agree that this is where it feels that it's most sort of like phony and The Rock-esque, where he's got like, look, I got the big smile, everybody would love me necessarily, but it's just like, no, you seem like a dude who just spends way too much time on the beach, and I don't want to hang around you as like my action adventure hero guy.
And again, I thought of The Mummy a lot while watching this, and even with someone like Brendan Fraser in that movie, where like, he indicates like there's an assuredness, but there's also like this air of like, you know, I'm also like gonna defer. For instance, like the whole dynamic with like Rachel Weisz, like the reason they have that fun chemistry is because she's not like what Penelope Cruz is in this movie. Like Rachel Weisz in The Mummy is not this like uptight person that Brendan needs to draw out of her shell. She is kind of crazy in a similar way. She's just a little more like bookish, and the fun thing is like watching their weird energy kind of bounce off each other, because they're both kind of a little unhinged. Whereas in this, it's just like when that scene, oh my god, it just stuck out to me because it just made my skin crawl, when he's like, I know a girl in Monterey and she's got a house and she's never there, and he kind of just takes it as a given that like they're gonna hook up by the end, and I'm just like, can you at least flirt a little? Try, maybe be like charming and not just assume. It feels like he's gonna look directly at the camera and be like, and I'm a guy in a movie, so you know I'm gonna get the girl by the end. Like that's what his air is. It's yeah. Just ugh.
Right. And Penelope Cruz doesn't help that she's just kind of like slotted into being that girl and not having much other chemistry or like actual like individuality or character beyond like, I am a doctor for the WHO. And therefore, I'm here to basically unveil this disease plot that you mentioned, where people turn into like fish flaky zombie creatures for some reason, and it, like just have the weird like back and forth with Glenn Turman, who of course the moment he showed up, just like, I wonder which one of these main characters is going to die first.
Gee.
I wonder.
Oh my god!
And you know that's the thing too, and I think you might be onto some there, Hale. The thing is about The Mummy, and even the first Pirates, and even Indiana Jones, and things like that. They're all the main guys are kind of fuck ups in those movies too. Like they just sort of succeed by sheer dumb luck sometimes, or just just straightforward like bullheadedness. And this, you know, he's just sort of got it all figured out all the time, and it's hard to like get behind a guy like that. Like it's like there's no real stakes there because you know he's going to get out of it. Where at least in like, you know, like I said, in The Mummy, Brendan Fraser gets the shit kicked out of him all the time. He's constantly like out of his element. Indiana Jones always got beat up. You know, Jack Sparrow is a moron. It's just there's no vulnerability to this character. So you don't really care.
Yeah, all the vulnerability is really just put onto Steve Zahn, which is, I think, the danger you sometimes have with these adventure movies, is you have the hero who's completely straight-laced and can get through anything, and then you got his buddy who's bumbling, just like, oh man, what am I gonna do? Which Steve Zahn was just in that mode at this time, which is like, that's all he was getting, was these kind of roles. And it's such a bummer, because I would like, in theory, I think he could be fun, but the trouble is, one, that chemistry with McConaughey, and two, more importantly, for this big action-adventure movie, it's got some of the best examples of terrible editing for a major studio American movie. Like, any of the action scenes are just chopped to shit. You can barely tell what's going on. Like, during the big boat chase, or during most any of these big action sequences, like, I don't even know where one person is in the scene anymore, because it's so heavily cut up.
The most egregious example was, like, when they're at that solar plant, I just, at that moment, my eyes glazed over. I was playing a game on my phone. I was checking emails. I was like, I don't understand. Like, I was done. I was checked out. like nasty. Because at that point, it's just like the movie doesn't help itself because it's a solar plant. So like the bright gleaming sun is bouncing off of every surface and I can't even see, like it hurts my eyes to look at. So it's just like, what are we doing here? Like he's like hanging off of the edge of a building. And at that point, I'm just like, just die, just fall off. Like, I'm done with this.
Yeah, especially when, like we said, like, this starts off a bit more as, like, a grounded, like, oh, he's going to be on a boat, and, like, the first big action set piece is them on a boat getting shot up by a bunch of guys who are trying to, like, stop them, basically. Which, in theory, could be fun, but then as we go along, each set piece has to expand even further to the point of just ridiculousness, and this is made by Breck Eisner, son of Michael Eisner, previous guy who ran Disney. And we've talked about his remake of The Crazies. And the biggest problem with that movie is it's mostly kind of like grounded as a horror action movie until the very end there's like a nuclear bomb explosion. It's like, what if that nuclear bomb explosion was the whole like second half of the movie, basically? Because it gets just so dumb and ridiculous to the point where it's just like, well, this guy in theory was an actual person, so I don't really give that much of a shit. Like, oh, he's able to survive a solar panel thing to destroy toxic waste or whatever the fuck is going on.
Yeah, and the action scenes, I mean, even the boat one carries on a little too long, but yeah, they get more outlandish and just last forever too, to where any excitement that you might get out of it quickly is whittled down just by how much there is. Like the car chase scene with the helicopter, like God, it takes forever. And then just, I love that they just so happen to find that fucking boat he's looking for and blah, 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 blah. It gets so outlandish and outrageous that I'm right there with you. I was tuning out like 100%. I kept like hitting the pause button like to see how much longer I had to go with this movie. It's entirely too long. If this movie did not need to be over 2 hours long.
No, and what do you think sort of in this movie really just sort of like killed the adventure genre? Like, given how big a budget this was and how much it inflated, like, do you think like this was responsible for killing the genre as it was at that time?
I don't think it's solely responsible. Mainly because like, who remembers that this movie exists? You know what I mean? Like, Sahara is a very like, which again, like another thing, why is it called that? They don't even address, they're in Mali, but that's besides the point. I think it's more just emblematic of a thing that we continue to see, which is that like people take for granted the character work that goes into like those fun adventure classics. Like what we were talking about with like The Mummy or with Indiana Jones, like there's cool action beats to be sure, but people also remember like fun, like character things. They remember like little interactions. They remember like funny, like state, like, you know, oh, Benny, you're on the wrong side of the river and things like that. Like, you know, like that's the stuff that's fun. And I feel like, you know, the focus is on like bombast and like the action. And that's only part of it. Like the adventure is only as fun as like the people that you're on the adventure with. If the people you're on the adventure with are unbearable, you're not going to have fun no matter how much, you know, shiny, flashy things they throw at you on the screen.
Right. That's part of the charm with like Indiana Jones. His introduction is this amazing sequence where he's able to escape a giant boulder and stuff like that. And the punctuation point is him being scared of snakes. So it's like, oh, there is a humanity to him because he's like fearful of something we experience every day. Just like, oh my God, it's a snake. It's a human fear. As opposed to Matthew McConaughey, who, as you mentioned, is like, nah, I don't got nothing to worry about. I'm going to get the girl and I'm going to survive solar blasts or whatever. I'm good.
Yeah, no, it's like these like adventures are which, you know, we'll get into with the second movie. Like they're human stories. Like it's kind of like a fun bedtime story or something where like you want to kind of put yourself in that position. Like, what would it be like if I was like the super cool guy, but he's not just a super cool guy, which is what these things kind of forget. Like it's this big focus on like very choreographed spectacle, or in this case, super poorly choreographed. And it's just, I feel like that's where they fail.
Yeah, no, I agree. They become action porn. It becomes just like you said, just look how much shiny stuff, explosions we got. And these guys are attractive, so you want them to succeed. And yeah, there is none of those character beats. There is none of that stuff. And I don't think this like single-handedly brought down the adventure sort of genre of films, but it definitely probably had a hand in it. Mainly because of the budget and the fact that it is based on, you know, source material that there are fans of and everything. And even with all of that and star power, it still failed. You know, at that rate, if something like this can fail, then it becomes too much of a risk. You know, if it's not a guaranteed winner, they're not going to do it anymore. And you know, this could have been, like I said, this could have been a fun little movie. It really, really could have. If there was more chemistry, if there was more, like I said, even wacky comedy, like they do in The Mummy with certain scenes and other, in Pirates and things like that. It just, there's one real bit with the plane that they windsurf across, and then that's kind of it. The rest is just, you don't care. And mainly because there's like three major plots going on at one time. There's the guy with the water, the Merovingian, and then there's the, you know, the disease that's spreading that the sort of warlord knows about. And then there's the hunt for this treasure. Oh, but then there's also William H. Macy and Delroy Lindo, and they're back and forth.
Oh, yeah. By the way, we forgot to mention they're in this movie, by the way. Two great actors who just pop up to get a paycheck.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Oh, it's 100%.
But you know what? Good for them. I mean, in William H. Macy's case, that's going to bribing UCLA to let his daughter in or whatever. But in Delroy Lindo's case, absolutely, sir. Get your bag. Absolutely. Like, go ahead. He kills the Merovingian by the end. Have fun. Go ahead. That paid for, like,
you know,
a summer home. Maybe a boat. Who knows?
Well, I mean, I guess we should sort of wind down here. Adam, you pretty much had final thoughts, unless you have anything else to add about Sahara.
Just that the fact that when the Merovingian shows up on screen in the very, like, sort of first 5 minutes, was there any doubt in anybody's mind that he's the villain? Like, instantly? Like, oh, yeah, he's in on it. Oh, and big ups to the... It's just, the problem is, it's not the worst movie I've ever seen by any means. It's not even the worst adventure movie I've seen. But it's so ultimately forgettable. Like, in 6 months, I'm not going to remember a single plot point in this movie. Other than that, there was, like, a ton of them. And none of them gel together.
Well, Hale, anything to add for final thoughts?
I was just going to say, like, when Adam said, like, when the Merovingian shows up and you're just kind of like, oh, yeah, that's the villain. I think the fact that we can't remember the guy's name and that we all just kind of call him the Merovingian and everybody knows who we're talking about indicates that that poor man's reputation is just the jerk in everything, which is a little funny. But no, yeah, same thing. I mean, I was just kind of baffled by, like, how aggressively, like, because it's not even that it's like mediocre, it's that, like, it fumbles so incredibly hard. The fact that you have to sit there and be like, right, so there's this Mali warlord who is deliberately poisoning the water system because it makes money and he's exploiting the fact that people forget about Africa. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, that is way too much table setting for a treasure hunt or whatever. And that may be why it sticks out of my head a little bit more. Like, I'll just kind of turn to people and be like, you know, there's this crazy movie that exists, but you don't have to watch it because it's super boring. It's not even fun, bad. But yeah, ultimately, it made me want to rewatch The Mummy. So that's probably what I'm going to do this weekend. But yeah, not fun. Not at all.
Yeah, I mean, echo everything here. I'll just shout out Lambert Wilson is that man's name. Someone needs to remember that name, Lambert Wilson.
I'm sorry, Merv.
Sorry, Merv. but yeah, agree with everything. Also, another person who was wasted, Lenny James, as that actual warlord, who's been great in other things. I'm glad he's getting those Walking Dead paychecks. But unfortunately, yeah, he, amongst a lot of other great people, are just kind of wasted in whatever the hell this movie was. But let's go ahead and get to our good movie, which we've been chomping at the bit to talk about, rightly so. We are talking about Master and Commander, The Far Side of the World.
That needs, like, reggaeton fog horns, like, meow, 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 like...
Two feet 6 inches, sir.
The men would follow you anywhere. As a friend, I would say that we should have turned back weeks ago.
It's leadership they want. Strength. Find that within yourself, and you will earn their respect.
Courage, lads!
When we board, you'll take him out of the ship.
Take him out of the ship. Thank you, sir.
For home! And for the prize!
See you afterwards.
Let's fly!
So, Master and Commander, this came out November 14th, 2003, from director, co-writer Peter Weir, also based on a series of novels from Mr. Patrick O'Brien, and this was a movie where I hadn't seen it before this, and I had remembered it coming out, though, because it was the same year, just a couple months after Pirates of the Caribbean had come out and had wowed me as a youth. And I'm just like, oh my God, this is so great. And I was like, oh, another ship movie, but they're all in like naval uniforms. I don't know. It doesn't really interest me that much. And I'd heard, though, from so many people, like, oh, this is so great. I wish we'd gotten a sequel to continue these characters. And I'm like, oh, I should see it at some point. And now was that point. And I'm so dumb. I should have seen this a long time ago because this movie's fucking excellent. And it's so great. And I totally get the hype now. I know, Adam, you had seen this before. And you kept praising me for merely picking it when I told you this is what we were going to do.
I've seen this movie probably, oh, man, 5-6 times at this point, if not more. I saw this at the show and for a very shallow reason. I saw this at the show and because the music that played during one of the trailers, if not the main trailer, was the same music from the Dune miniseries. Where to tie that in. So honestly, I was like, well, at least they picked good music. So I had to go see it. And yeah, I instantly fell in love with this movie. Hands down, probably my favorite Russell Crowe. It's easily one of my favorite Paul Bettany's. It's probably my favorite sort of like sword and scabbard ship movie. I think it's fucking just absolutely perfect portrayal of, you know, sense of duty to sense of sort of morality to sense of, you know, legacy to, I mean, it's just, this movie is just, this movie don't fuck around, man. It's pretty fantastic.
Well, Hale, I'm curious, what's your relationship with this movie? Had you seen it before or whatever? And it seemed from some of your earlier comments you might have enjoyed it, but please elaborate.
Yeah, so I, you know, I'm clearly the youngest one here. I was like maybe 3 when this movie came out, but it was one of those that like I heard about it a lot, especially like the older I got, the more into like film I got. And it was one of those things where, especially, there's this other podcast that I'm a huge fan of, Blank Check, and one of the co-hosts of Blank Check, like he's constantly talking about this movie and he loves it so much. And again, like Thomas, it was one of those movies that like was kind of always on my list, but I never got around to it. But I love ships. I love I'm from the Caribbean, so like I love the ocean. And when I sat down to watch this, it was like, oh my God, I love a good boat movie. Like anything that just takes me through like the geography of, but like that first opening like battle scene where they're going all the way top to bottom and they're just showing you everything, all the hammocks where everybody's sleeping and the little holes for the cannons, all that stuff. I was just like, yes, like inject it into my veins. I love this stuff. I loved it. It was so much fun. It flew right by. When I finally got towards the end, I had to pause it to go do something. I was like, wait a minute, there's only that much left. Like, I absolutely loved it. I'm so annoyed I hadn't seen this sooner. But yeah, it was a great old Dudes Rock. Like that, this is like peak like Dudes Rock movie for me. Like this is joining the canon with like Another Round. And I don't know, like I just, God, what a good movie. What a good time.
It's a great Dudes Rock cinema, confirmed. Yes, especially like that friendship between Crowe and Bettany is so perfect throughout the whole movie. Because like there's such a great contrast where Crowe is so much more about like, no, I have to like, you know, I love the sea, I love my ship, I love my crew. But at the same time, I have to stick to my mission of trying to catch this ghost ship that's facing us. Versus Paul Bettany is just like, well, I don't know, I also love the men in our crew. And that's where like they sort of have the mutual respect. It's like they really love the people on their crew and each other included. But he's just like, but I love the idea of like exploring the world out there and actually going to like the Galapagos and shit like that. And you can see how they're two very different men, but how they do respect each other and really love each other down to their fucking jam sessions. I would watch a whole movie of their fucking jam sessions where they're just rocking out on like the violin and all that shit. Like, fuck yeah, yes. So good. I want to live in this.
Or the dinners with the puns. So good.
Oh my God, I died. I was so mad at how hard that made me laugh. Like, I kept repeating it to myself, just puttering around my house. The lesser of two weevils.
And it also helps that Russell Crowe sells that joke. He laughs his ass off when he tells it. Like, he could barely get the words out. He's choking on the punchline.
Yeah. He dissolves like a fifth grader telling a yo mama joke at the lunch table, and I'm just obsessed with it. Like, it's so good. Everybody in this is so good. There's so many, like, stalwart British faces. that, like, those guys, like, I can never, I'm so bad with, like, British dudes' names, but there were so many faces that every time they popped up, I was like, hey, you, like an old buddy. I was so happy.
Billy Boyd shows up. You're like, hey, great, Peregrine Took. But the scene that really does it for me, man, is when, you know, Paul Bettany's down in his quarters, you know, and he's telling him, like, you know, I really don't think you need to lash him and blah, 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 blah. And Russell Crowe gives that whole speech. I'm like, you know, no, you have to lead them and blah, blah, blah. Like, and it's just so, and then they're watching the lashing happening. And Russell Crowe, you can tell, is being so, like, stalwart, and he's the captain, but you can just see it behind his eyes that he's like, this is fucked. But Paul Bettany, man, that surgery scene.
Oh my god!
Some harrowing ass shit, man. Oh my god!
This movie is so great for what it doesn't show. It reminded me of Old, which you have both of you seen that?
Yes.
Oh yeah, mid-sized sedan, baby.
Yeah, but the whole tumor scene where it's playing with, like, and obviously Old is much more heightened or whatever. This one's a lot more grimy and realistic, but still, like, it's, you know, what it doesn't show you, that the scene with the amputation with the little boy, whose name I forget, but like those moments, and even the surgery scene, you're not really seeing much of it. The whole time you're kind of almost in like Paul Bettany POV, where you're just kind of seeing it, like, in the corner of the mirror, but really what's guiding that scene is everybody else's faces, and they're doing some great, like, squeamish face acting.
Right, and I love the fact also that it's so, like, in that sequence you're talking about with the amputation, you would figure, like, oh, this is going to go along for a while, there's going to be, like, bone cracking sounds, all this horrible stuff, but it's so quick. It just shows that, like, the precision that Paul Bettany has, and then ultimately just being like, well, you're one of the bravest patients I've ever had, it instantaneously, like, warms your heart after you've just seen, like, a young boy get his arm amputated, but you just feel, like, that weird emotional roller coaster of, like, oh my god, it's happening, oh wait, it happened, and oh, you're being very nice to this young boy. It really just immerses you in those, like, very quick change of pace feelings, because you're on a ship, shit's gotta, like, get done, you gotta, like, get past this and keep going. I think it really gets you into that kind of, like, almost stream of consciousness.
Yeah, it's really good at, like, even something as simple as, like, which is a little trick that when I noticed it, I was like, ugh, let me see, like, how long it takes me to get sick of it. But I never did. The fact that the camera's constantly just swaying with the ship. Mm-hmm. And it's just, like, such a good little detail. Because it's just enough to where you notice it. But by, like, the halfway point, you barely really notice it, unless there's like scenes that change where like they're on the shore or like whatever. But I love just those little I just love being on a boat. Like, I love that stuff. Like, you know, Titanic and even like the Pirates movies. Like, I just love when it's just like dudes on boats. I love
jungle,
that stuff.
Jungle Cruise. Right, Jungle Cruise, yes.
Even like a moment that I expected was going to be, which it's so funny the way there's a line in this movie that describes like movie perfectly, where when Russell Crowe's character is telling the story about like the famous sailor that he served with. And he said that like his love of country kept him warm. And he says that comment where he's like, hearing it from any other man and you'd be like, ugh, how silly or whatever. And that is literally just how I feel about this movie. So much of what happens here, I feel like any other movie, any other actors, and you'd kind of be like, I don't know, this is just extra. But with this, it's just like, it's just great. Everybody's like doing such great work, and it's just, it looks great, and it sounds great, and it's just so good.
Yeah, shout out to it. One for both sound editing and cinematography at the Oscars, which, especially in a year where like that was the Return of the King year, where it's just like, fuck everything else. Everything goes to Return of the King. So I can get a couple of awards like that's pretty impressive. But yeah, it works because, yeah, the sound editing is so good, especially just the small details of like, and this is also visual, obviously, but the fact that they have to set up Russell Crowe's office wall every time they're downstairs. And I have to, like, put together... I love that detail. You never think about that, but it's like, oh, yeah, of course they have to do that, because they can't have that place completely, like, started off the entire day. It has to be, like, his office at night only. And I just love small details like that that, like Hale said, like, really immerse you in this environment, where it's just like, yep, you're living on the ship with these guys in this realistic-looking ship that sometimes is an actual huge, large-scale ship, sometimes it's, like, really indistinguishable models from Weta, that just, like, edit together so perfectly. It's just astonishing how much you're just really immersed in this environment.
Yeah, and even little subtle things, like when they're going through and there's snow on the ship and they're panning by the ship and you see some of them having a snowball fight. real quick.
Yes.
And things like that. You just get the real sense of camaraderie between the crew. And Thomas, I want to ask you, correct me if I'm wrong, but Jenny, you're rather hot and cold on Russell Crowe, right?
I mean, I guess so. I just, with the Russell Crowe persona, I think I kind of like it better when he leans into more of like the genre-y aspects like this, as opposed to like a Gladiator or super stone-faced. Like stone-faced Crowe, I'm just like so checked out, as opposed to this guy who's just like on the ship, who's the leader and commander, but also has like a jovial sensibility to him. Just like, fuck yeah, this is my Crowe. Like this, or
oh, yeah, he's great.
Even as of recently with like Unhinged, just like, fuck yeah, weird-ass crazy Russell Crowe. Hell yeah.
There's no question that he is the captain of the ship. There's no he sort of commands that performance. Like he's just 100%. You get why these guys are behind him. I don't know if it's because of his beautiful hair or it's just the way he, like you said, can show sort of this real sense of command, but also compassion. And also, you know, making these guys go through these horrible drills to shoot the cannons, but he's constantly like, you know, good job. And hey, more extra rational grog for you, Ben, and all that stuff. Like he's just, you get 100% why these guys would follow him to wherever he needs to go, even to the end point of the film, to where he's not going to give up. He's not going to give up getting this captain. And Paul Bettany, unfortunately, reluctantly, now has to go with him on this other trip instead of getting to do what he wants to do, because it's all for Russell Crowe's sense of duty. And it's just such a really cool way to end it.
But even then, like how there was the earlier point where him and Bettany are like arguing with each other, but like, no, we can't go to the Galapagos. We have to do this or whatever, blah, blah, blah. And then it's not until like he's been hit and he actually has done something so brave, Bettany, that he has to do like the surgery by himself. And then Crowe just like kind of tosses off just like, oh yeah, we'll stay here for about a week, you know, we gotta get everybody together, and plus, you know, you could probably go gallivant around and find your creatures or whatever. It's this really beautiful moment where it's just like, oh, this is so touching. These two buddies who were at odds with each other, now he's able to like give Paul Bettany this thing, just like, ah, to name a prickly rock after me or something like that. Just like, oh, perfect. It's like, hey, I'll say Dude's Rock, and this is the best example of Dude's Rock.
Paul Bettany is so good at playing this like tenderness, which is what makes him especially like I when I was younger and I was like getting really into like Marvel comics, I hated Vision. I really did not like him. And Vision in the MCU is honestly one of my favorite characters because Paul Bettany has this like vulnerability to him that doesn't irritate me. This quiet dignity when he comes to Russell Crowe and he's kind of like, you made me a promise. And it's kind of like, yeah, buddy. He did. I'm so sorry. Like, I want you to go look at the iguanas too. Like, it was just this moment where, like, I don't know, like, it's not like contrived at all. You can because the whole movie has just kind of been setting up with you that, like, there's this deep bond between these two guys. So, like, you can tell that, like, when he reneges on this promise and he's kind of like waving him away, you could tell that it genuinely cuts deep when he's like, we don't have time for your hobbies, guy. And it's like, ow, like, don't say that.
Right. But I also love the sort of resolve of that. Like Thomas brought up when he's like, you know, Paul Bettany's like, please tell me this, all this wasn't for me. I don't know how to thank you. And Russell Crowe's response is like, posh, it's not for you. Like he just, no.
When he says, name a shrub after me. Oh, yeah, I died. I had to pause to like laugh, cry. I was just like, these dudes, man.
And how well that's reciprocated by Bettany when he discovers the ship on the other side of the island. He's like, oh fuck, I have to like abandon this. And like he has to like let go of the iguanas and all these other things he was going to carry as a specimen. It's just like, you know how much that hurts that dude. But he has to because like it's for the good of everybody else and I have to keep this going. Because the movie's also established so well like the sort of domino effect of when people get screwed over with like other people on the ship. Like there's the two guys who end up being like, oh hey, these are the specs of the ship that we're facing off against. Great, give them some rum rations. And later on, one of those guys is the guy that goes overboard and his buddy has to see as they have to abandon that guy for the safety of everyone else on the ship. And that resolves into like him being so resentful of like the higher up guys, one of which is like the guy who like he bumps into and the whipping happens and that one dude commits suicide. Just it establishes so perfectly, like if everyone's not on the same page, shit gets fucked up and people die, sometimes on their own hands, sometimes because like we can't do much for them after a certain point. We have to save everybody else. It does such a great job of establishing all that. So when the Bettany and Crowe relationship ends up getting like a sort of tit for tat about like, oh, I'll give you this chance, but I have to like remove this chance so we can help you guys out, it establishes so much that there needs to be a balance between everybody on the ship.
And when that little boy gives him that beetle, get the fuck out of here. That is such a great scene. It's so good. Like, you could tell Paul Bettany's about to fucking cry in that scene, dude. It's so, so good. And yeah, he just says this such sense of warmth and compassion to him, where he genuinely not only cares for Jack, but everyone on the ship. He just wants everyone to be okay and everyone to get through it and everyone to survive. And it's just, oh God, I love this movie so much. I love this movie.
This is one of those movies where I look at Paul Bettany and, like, I had a moment when he became Vision. I kind of had a weird Paul Bettany stan moment when I was like 15 or whatever. And it's a thought that happens to me, like, where I'm just like, what happened to you, buddy? Cause he's like really good and he doesn't do enough work. Like, you know what I mean?
Legion and Priest happened. If I
have
to pick.
Well, I think the thing, it's kind of weird because this is like the other movie that they were in besides A Beautiful Mind with him. Bad movie, yes, 100%. But the weird thing is, like, that movie is the weird divergent point where, like, Crow became a huge, massive star with, like, the combination of that and Gladiator. And then Paul Bettany just became, like, character actor dude. He's just like, well, I'm going to keep scrounging through all this, but, you know, I'm going to keep working. And that dude keeps working. And he's also married to Jennifer Connelly, so good on him. You know,
then he pops up in Inkheart, which, oh my God, if there was ever something that formed my personality more than Inkheart. But, like, he pops up in these things where I'm just like, well, I mean, and he has talked about how, like, when he got the role to play Vision, he was like at his wit's end in Hollywood. His agent had just, like, dumped him, which is like this super sad article that I remember reading where I'm just like, you're really good. I don't understand how this happened.
Yeah, and he especially when you see him in this movie, it's just like so, like, he so deserved a better career after this point.
Was he nominated for Best Supporting Actor? Because if he wasn't, I'm going to...
Oh, for this movie, no.
Commit a felony. No. Jesus.
Oh, no. Well, which one are you going to do? Are you going to pull a tag off a mattress? Come on, do something rebellious. But no, I mean, it is a shame that, like, you know, him and even some, like, the other people, like, what I love about this movie is how well cast it is. I think that's a real asset to Peter Weir as a director. When you, from everything like The Truman Show or this, or even Dead Poets, like, there is no small role. Every actor makes an impression. Even if you don't recognize that dude's, like, character name, they make a good impression. Like, I love the big lunk dude who, during, like, the big surgery scene, is holding the mirror and he just, like, is averse to the blood, just like, oh, I can't look. And later on, he's carrying Paul Bettany around and shit like that. We're just like, that dude doesn't have a lot of lines or whatever. I'm just like, oh, I love that guy. He's so great on the ship and he plays such an integral role, clearly. Like, I don't know who that fucker's name is, but he's great. And that's the thing. Even, like, the little boy who is missing the arm, everybody else, like, you have such compassion for every single member of that ship just from, like, the way those actors portray these roles that, like, could just be thankless. Everybody is like, makes an impact to you. So when the big shit goes down with the ship, you're concerned. We're like, oh fuck, not the one bureaucratic guy who was just like, no, we can't do this. He gets shot in the head. No, not
that guy.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Like, shot nasty. Yeah. I even the kids are really good in this, which is always like kind of hit or miss with little boys and little girls and things. But the kids in this are really good. Like, they're not whiny, they're not annoying, they're really good. I like that they kind of they're nice to these boys. They don't shield them from like the responsibilities. They are a part of the crew same as everybody else, but there is just this like delicacy that they treat these kids with.
That scene where Crow gives him the fucking book is so good. It's like, I heard you were fond of reading. Oh, and I was actually a part of this battle. If you go to page 123, I believe, I was part of this one. It's just like, oh, it's so endearing. We're like, yeah, they're not shielding these kids. They're not, like, trying to completely guard them. Because, like, no, you're a part of the crew. But at the same time, they're fully invested in just like, well, we want you to still have, like, fun. And you're a part of everything. Like, even, there's, like, I don't know if it's that kid or some other kid, but, like, it's just a part of, like, the big dinner scene. There's, like, all these adult-ass men, just, like, some little boy who's, like, drinking meat or whatever. Just like, yeah. Have him participate. What the fuck ever. There's no kids table here. Everybody's a part of the table.
I don't know. There's just like, it's weird to call something like this delicate, but there's so much, like, so many of these little small character beats that you wouldn't really expect from like this grand sweeping epic. I really like to, it's a small thing, but like you never see the Frenchmen. There's no moment where you cut to the other boat until they've boarded that boat. You are firmly just a member of this crew, which I think really adds to just like the experience of it. which just makes me wish that we had gotten like a sequel and stuff. Not that everything needs to be a franchise, but I want to be on a boat with these guys for longer.
Yeah, I agree with you. There's no, you know, up until the sort of the one that you don't know, but there's no real face-to-face with him and the other captain. Like, there's no, like, you know, give me your terms and blah, 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 blah. There's none of that. And I really appreciated that, too. I didn't want to sort of come across a mustache-twirling villain. You know, it could have very easily been the Merovingian again, that type of character. And it wasn't. He's virtually faceless up until like 30 seconds at the end, and you know, our character that we're following doesn't even know it's him. And I really, really appreciated that too.
Yeah, I like the fact that it almost feels like Steven Spielberg's Duel, where it's just this massive ship that's coming by. I like the fact that it's just like it is a faceless entity that just keeps popping up. It is almost like the shark in Jaws.
It adds to this cool element where I love the way they, and you know, these are English soldiers and they are, you know, they're Christian or whatever. I don't remember what denomination English people, I don't know. They're Protestant. I know that much, but I like that there's this weird sort of mysticism that the ocean lends to. Like when you set things on the ocean, it's just like the ocean is this, it might as well be another world for as much as we know about it. So I love when movies set in like the sea kind of lean into that mysticism. There's that whole thing where like Mr. Hollum or Holland, whatever his name is, that he's the Jonah and all the crew can't really stand him. And there is kind of, and well, there's even that moment where Russell Crowe, like he tells Paul Bettany, he's like, I can't blame the crew. Like nobody tolerates a Jonah. And Paul Bettany's like, oh my God, you think he's a curse too? And it's like, yeah, like it's the ocean. Like things get weird out here.
Yeah, particularly Crowe's response of just like, not everything is in a book.
Yeah, and I like that they kind of play with that, where sure enough, the second he kills himself, the tide turns, you know, the rains fall and the wind picks up and everything. And it's like, you know, is it causality? Is it just this weird coincidence? The movie never explains it. But then also the ghost, the fact that is it the cook? No, it's that guy. Oh my God. I was about to say, I forgot. When Paul Bettany like puts a coin in some guy's head to like repair his skull. Yes. Or something like that. Oh my God, that's so cool. I love that so much.
I love that everyone's gathered around too. Like, this is the only entertainment they get is a horrible surgery.
That's even the guy and he shoos them away just to kind of get a closer look himself. I'm obsessed with that. But like, that guy throughout the whole movie, he's kind of like, you know, he's your old guy, like nattering on about weirdness. But I like that he's kind of like the weird mystical guy. Like he'll say like that ship's going to send us all to hell and that ship's a ghost ship and all these things. And he is right. Cause it's like, it's almost like Captain Ahab and his white whale, where it's like, is this even worth it at the end? And how much of this is even real? And it's just so cool.
Yeah. And I think that's the big bummer for like why this movie, I think, despite doing decently well, like why it didn't have a franchise, is since it just came after Pirates of the Caribbean, which I think is a great fun movie, but also so much more overt about like, no, there are like these mysterious creatures and there's like actual like dark magic or whatever, and we see skeleton pirates and
more
stuff.
More firm fantasy, yeah.
Right. I think that coming out just a few months before this did kind of helped sink the idea that it would get more sequels after this point, because more people were like, no, we want that adventure as opposed to this, which is kind of a shame. I mean, Adam, I'm obviously, you would have wanted to have more sequels, I assume, with everybody here.
Yes. But at the same time, really like that it's sort of just this. This is what we got. Because it's so perfect. The potential to have sort of the modern, you know, like Pirates or those type of movies influence the sequels as it went on, to me would be too great. I like that this exactly what it is. I think it's perfect that it's as a standalone. There's no point in me that is like, oh my God, what happens to, you know, Lucky Jack next and all that. I'm good. I think this is a perfect one and done-er.
I don't know. I mean, you didn't want the thread of like, oh, we're getting a Peter Miles spinoff movie, 2032. Yeah. That's what we don't even want the giant, the Masters of and Commander Universe, the MCU, as it were.
Hey.
I completely agree with you. I think the fact that this is a one and done makes this so special. At the same time, if some benevolent soul dedicated the rest of his life to coding, like some sort of like Sea of Thieves mod where it's just I get to just live in this all day, like for a couple hours, I would be very, very content, because this is just such a fun. And it's not fun. Like, I like that it is grimy. It is gross. Like, you know, when people are like injured and unwell at like the deep bowels of the ship, like it doesn't skimp on that. But at the same time, you're also like singing ditties on deck, like with your friends.
I think calling this fun is appropriate in a way. I absolutely think so, because it is such a level of excitement and sort of, like I said, the almost swashbuckling element of it, even though there's not much of that, but just the, you know, oh man, this is what it could have been like back then. And you're following these sort of characters that you really get to like, and they do have those great moments together. And, you know, even one of my favorite lines of the movie is, you know, who is this man? You know, did I wrong him before in some battle, or God forbid, kill his son?
And oh, Paul man. Bettany,
like, he fights just like you. And, you know, Russell Crowe gives that little smirk and then walks off. Or even at the end, he's like, you know, we're disguising ourselves from a predator. And he's like, you are the predator. Like, it's just, there's so many good little bits like that with Russell Crowe, and he'll just do this flash of a smile and things like that. Cause it's just, it's so fucking good. Oh, God. And
that is a perfect contrast to like the problem that we had with Matthew McConaughey in the last movie. Whereas, you know, Russell Crowe's not telling me I am cool, you should like me. He just is, because he's kind to his crew, but he's firm and he's decisive, but he's also like, you know, he'll bend to counsel and he'll, you know, all these things where it's like, that's a person. That's a guy that was that you could believe that was a guy who was sailing the seven seas or whatever. Like, that is a real human person who has friends, who has connections, like, you know.
And there's also those great moments, though, where the other characters tell you how cool he is without him having to do it himself. 300 feet from him in the night. I mean, that is just brilliant seamanship. Brilliant, brilliant seamanship.
I love that, like, whenever Russell Crowe kind of has these moments that you're talking about, Adam, where it's just like someone, he acknowledges it a bit, where it's just like, no, you're the predator. He's just like, well, I guess I am kind of cool. Yeah. Now. That was just duty for me, but I guess.
And I think it's so smart of this movie to open with that first battle, because since you're thrown into the midst of it, you understand, like, you've already seen him in action. So when people are saying, like, you know, this is Lucky Jack and the men will follow you anywhere, what have you, you've seen it. Like, that was the first 10 minutes of the movie. You get it. You saw this guy getting blown up at and leading his men and saving them ultimately by getting them out of the fog and all these things. So it works. It's just like very, very neat, tidy filmmaking that I hate being like, I hate whenever I have to say that, but I wish we got it more often, man. We need little things like this, just little one and dones in these specific settings.
Yeah. And it really carries all the way down to like that ending montage is so perfect, where it leaves you kind of wanting that sequel we were talking about, because you got the half the crew going on the other ship and the other half are staying on this ship, all set to like the two of them having their last jam session where they just screw the bows or whatever. And they're just going the picking their violins, stuff like that. It's such a perfect way to encapsulate, like, everybody is on the ship and everybody is like off on another adventure. It's just like, well, we can't spare any time. We have to like go off. This is one of the few movies in the 21st century I would genuinely describe as rousing.
Yep.
Like, we don't get a movie you could describe as rousing that much anymore. Which is like immediately like lifts your stomach up from like whatever pit it was in during a suspenseful sequence, where it's just like, fuck yeah, I want to sail the seven seas. I want to like set the mast or whatever the fuck. I don't know these terms that well, but I just love the fact that it inspires that kind of feeling.
You want to go on an adventure, which I think ultimately, like, that's like the thesis of the thing. Like, that's what the best kinds of these movies do. Like, you know that, like, if you put me in the middle of like some seafaring voyage in the 1800s, I am dying of dysentery within like 30 seconds. But I like the idea of playing pretend of like, yeah, throw me into the desert with Brendan Fraser, throw me on this boat with Russell Crowe and Paul Bettany. Like, those are the best kinds, where it's like, I want to be here, I love spending time here.
Yeah, in that situation, I think Adam and I are like getting our shoelaces tied in the cannonballs and we're falling overboard. That's basically what we're doing. Just ridiculous deaths immediately within seconds. But yeah, I think we've gone for a while. We should do some final thoughts here. Hale, please, as our guest, final thoughts on Master and Commander.
This is, it's so great. It's not overrated at all. Like, I know people sometimes have that instinct when you've heard these high praises for decades upon decades. It's such a great just thing to live in. I regret watching this on a laptop. This needs to be seen on like a huge screen. I'm going to single-handedly fund an IMAX restoration. So stay tuned for that. Cause we just, this is just such a fun time.
20th anniversary next year. Get it done. I'll go.
Oh my God. No, stop. Not listen. If I could, I absolutely would. But yeah, this is just such a great, thanks so much for you guys giving me this push to actually like see it. Cause I'm obsessed with it. Like this is going to be my new, this is a vibes movie for sure. And I don't mean that like in a belittling way. I mean like anytime it's like rainy and I feel kind of, I'm going to throw this on and have a great time. This is just such a fun, fun thing.
Well, and Adam, as an OG fan of Master and Commander, your final thoughts?
It's as good as it was, if not better, the first time I saw it. I mean, this movie holds up. It has stood the test of time. Everything about this movie just works. The cinematography, the score, the set design, the costuming, the acting, the stakes of it all. This movie is just a phenomenal, phenomenal adventure movie. And, you know, it's one that does have a lot of fans, but it's also one of those that sort of got lost at sea. Hey, boom, I'll stop. But it's just, it's so good that I anybody I know who has seen this on recommendation has walked away loving it. And I hope, you know, because of the show, maybe even if it's one or two more people, check it out and can fall in love with it. It is that good.
Yeah, I mean, I fell in love with it in a similar way. Yeah, where I felt angry at myself for not seeing this earlier. It's so stellar, it's so fun, and but it still has the amount of like stakes and terror that's there at the same time, and it balances all of that so perfectly with really great performances and everybody else. And it's one of those great movies where it's like we mentioned, despite being like about 2 hours 20 minutes long, it breezes by so quickly that it leaves you wanting more in the good way. Where it's just like, oh fuck, I want to hang out on this boat though with you guys. I want to join on the jam session with Paul Bettany and Russell Crowe. I want to be there with everybody. It just does such a great job at that. And like I said, one of the few rousing movies in recent memory. But it's time we did our weekly segment, where every week after we discuss our two features, we do a segment called The Double Redo, where every week Adam, myself, and a guest, if they're so inclined, program basically the best and worst possible double feature related to the topic at hand. So each of us has 4 movies, 2 good ones, 2 bad ones, 2 to recommend, 2 to not recommend, based in the adventure genre. And Adam, please go ahead first with your choices.
All right, so for my good choices, I have the aforementioned several times, The Mummy with Brendan Fraser and Rachel Weisz. It's just one of the most fun movies out there. Easily one of the most fun movies of the last, you know, 25 years. It's one of those that if you watch The Mummy and you don't have a good time and you don't smile, then you got to check your pulse, because it's so fun and silly. And yet the scares really work. The gore really works when there is gore. Great cast supporting all of them, like Arnold Vosloo's great. Odette Fair is great. It's just a super, super fun movie. It's one of those, anytime it's on, if I come across it, I'm definitely watching it. And then the other one I have is a, you know, sword movie, a knight movie. I have Excalibur. From, God, I want to say the early 80s. It's a huge cast, you know, Helen Mirren, Gabriel Byrne, Liam Neeson, like all these people show up in this movie, and it is super fun. It's just magic and sorcery and swords and the Arthurian legend. And it's a little hokey by today's standards, but I think that gives it a lot of its charm still. It's just, it's one of those I grew up watching. My dad was a big fan of it. And it's sort of has stuck with me and made me a fan of it. And again, anytime it's on, I'll watch it. For my bad, I have Kangaroo Jack. Anybody remember Kangaroo Jack? No, you don't. Kangaroo Jack was a terrible film about a CGI rapping kangaroo starring Jerry O'Connell and Anthony Anderson as well. And it's about as bad as that description says, if not worse. Dull, crappy comedy that, you know, there's no laughs, a lot of sort of outdated jokes when we were trying to make Jerry O'Connell a star, and it just didn't work. It's just a terrible, terrible film. And then my other pick is the Tom Cruise starring The Mummy. It is such a tone-deaf, stupid movie, and also has, you know, Russell Crowe in it as Jekyll and Hyde, because he's part of some secret organization or whatever the fuck. This was, like, I think the second or third attempt at bringing, you know, that fabled dark universe to life, and it just failed so miserably. I hope that's a dream that's dead, because it's just not going to work, and if you need proof, this is it. I mean, it's Tom Cruise. He's one of the biggest movie stars in the world. It's a remake of a beloved movie. Also starring Russell Crowe with updated special effects and action and, you know, exotic locales. And it just fails 100%. There is nothing redeeming about this movie.
Well, I'll just say I haven't seen Excalibur. The Mummy obviously is great. I think we can all agree on that here. In contrast to the Tom Cruise Mummy, the one with Brendan Fraser is so stellar. And the Tom Cruise one is just, I think, mostly infamous now for just that photo announcing the Dark Universe with everybody photoshopped together so terribly, just like Javier Bardem and Johnny Depp. It's going to be a huge thing. That didn't happen. It's a big hang-on-his-face moment. But Kangaroo Jack, I want to speak about, because that, as a young person, was such a massive disappointment to me, because you said the rapping kangaroo thing. That's what all the trailers advertised. That is a dream sequence in the movie. They advertised it all on a rapping kangaroo, which as a young man, I was just like, oh, of course, this is going to be brilliant comedy. Turns out it's this really bad crime comedy that was originally shot as like an R-rated comedy, and then they had to re-edit because it's like, well, the rapping kangaroo, it's going to sell with kids, so let's make it PG, and you can tell. And young Tom was just like, it's just the dream sequence. It's like Snow Dogs all over again. The dogs were supposed to talk, but it's Cuba Gooding Jr.
Let's be 100% honest. This is, by young Thomas, you mean like a year ago when you first saw the trailer.
Well, that's true, yes. It's like, oh man, on YouTube, just randomly showed up. I can't wait for Kangaroo Jack and Snow Dogs.
Stand by me himself and a rapid kangaroo. This is going to be tight.
I just need to chime in. You guys are disrespecting the other great thing that Tom Cruise Mummy gave us, which was that early uploaded trailer with all the weird IMAX sounds. And it's just, like that is modern art. Modern art. I think it's beautiful. I watch it all the time.
But I know you're obviously a big fan of like the Brendan Fraser Mummy.
Oh, for sure. I just showed it to I call her my little one, but she's my little sister. I just showed it to her the other day. She's, because that's, again, another one of those, it was on TV all the time movies that I grew up watching. And I forgot that it can get scary. It's kind of like a slasher movie when the mummy's putting himself back together and he's scooping up his jars one by one. It's just, God, it's such a fun time. There's nothing like it. I need it on like a 4K, like in an altar in my house. Like, it's just so much fun.
Well, I'll go ahead with my redo choices here. I have, for my good, an old classic adventure film and then a more recent one that's a bit more dark and interesting. The older one I have is the original Adventures of Robin Hood from 1938. We're talking the Errol Flynn classic Technicolor big scale movie, Basil Rathbone's in it, a bunch of other great people. And it's sort of like the everything you think of when you think of an old classic adventure movie, with like the swashbuckling element we mentioned earlier, or just a lot of people doing the thing that you see sort of like almost parody by the time you get to like Men in Tights, of people putting their hands on their hips and putting their heads back and laughing like, oh, we have our fun. It's pure classic adventure in a way that's really endearing and charming. And just constantly has like great stunt work and elaborate sets and these faces that you can only see in these old Technicolor things, like an Errol Flynn or Olivia de Havilland, people like that. Stellar old school adventure movie that I would recommend to anybody. Still has a lot of charm to it, despite being, you know, at this point like 90 years old. And then on contrast, I have The Lost City of Z, which is the James Gray film that stars Charlie Hunnam. And it's about a guy who's an adventurer and has, like, a crew around him, but it's a lot more grimy and dirty. Kind of fits into the Master and Commander terms of things, only it's a bit more sort of, like, intense. There's a bit more of, like, a thriller element with him on this expedition, and people are kind of, like, looking at each other a bit cross-eyed, and there's a great side performance from Robert Pattinson that's really stellar, where he's mangy, he's got, like, a big beard and stuff like that. It's a really great movie about just, like, sort of the toll that adventure takes on somebody, where you go on these big, elaborate adventures, and then you try and go back home again, and it's almost kind of like a Hurt Locker thing of just, like, oh, wait, I've kind of been distant and these people hate me now. So I have to, like, only life is really the adventure at this point. It's a really stellar, interesting movie from that just doesn't really come about that much. It feels almost like a modern David Lean movie. And then my two bad are both very odd ones, where I have one from the late 90s, Almost Heroes, which is sort of like a Lewis and Clark comedy parody of some of these adventure films that stars Matthew Perry, and it was, I believe, one of the last films starring Chris Farley to come out. It came out like a year after he died, and you can tell both of them had had substance abuse issues, and it feels very much like it's a comedy without laughs. It's really dire. There's a pretty good supporting cast around them. It's kind of wasted. Pretty terrible movie that has been forgotten with good reason. And then the other bad one, I have one of the Pirates of the Caribbean sequels, this one specifically, On Stranger Tides, which this is the fourth one, and a lot of people sort of lump all the Pirate sequels together as, like, failed experiments, but I have a lot more credit and respect for the two that Gore Verbinski did before this, Dead Man's Chest and At World's End, where both of those are at least kind of, like, ambitious and big and weird in a way that On Stranger Tides and the one that followed, Dead Men Tell No Tales, just aren't. There's none of that, like, big-scale, like, fun adventure. It just feels like it's expensive trash. And this one in particular has so much of that, where it's, like, everybody on autopilot, and they don't have Keira Knightley and Orlando Bloom anymore, so they replace them with, like, very generic copies of copies, one of which is a mermaid, which is really weird as well, but not exciting. And it's directed by a Rob Marshall, who is no Gore Verbinski, you can tell the entire time. And somehow this awful, boring doll movie is one of the most successful movies of all time, because it made over $1 billion. And that's just a travesty.
You know, I speak on yours really quick. I know I've seen the Errol Flynn Robin Hood. It's been forever. I remember liking it. It's definitely something that I want to watch again. Lost City of Z is one of those that I absolutely think it's phenomenal, and it's one that nobody saw. It's a great movie, and it's probably the best Charlie Hunnam's ever been in anything outside of TV work. It's great. And yeah, Pattinson, amazing side performance from him. Almost Heroes. Yeah, that's just a bummer of a movie for so many reasons. Like you said, one, Chris Farley's last thing. Two, the substance abuse is clearly running rampant. And it's just, you know, it's unfunny. And ultimately, that's, you know, one of the biggest problems. It's a comedy movie that garners zero laughs.
By the way, I didn't mention this, directed by Christopher Guest.
Yeah, well, that's even worse. Yeah,
it's even weirder, yes.
But then, yeah, Pirates 4, you know, with 4 and 5, they're like, okay, let's take bits that we did in the first one, the second one, the third one, and then let's just roll them together to make this movie. And then, hey, it made $1 billion. Let's do it again in 5. And yeah, it's just, it's terrible. I mean, you know, another one starring Penelope Cruz that we talked about earlier, to where the whole bit where she's dressed as Jack and no one can realize that it's not Johnny Depp, and it's just laughably stupid and absurd. And the whole mermaid stand-in with the young missionary, like, you don't give a fuck.
Also, Ian McShane as Blackbeard sounds so great.
It sounds great. It should have been great. Yes. Completely wasted.
I contributed to that gajillion-dollar box office, and I feel really bad about that, like, constantly. Which is leading into, like, when I get to my picks, it's just, like, I feel bad. I have never seen Lost City of Z, but, like, Zed, as I've heard people call it. But it's always one of those that, I forget that it exists, and then I'll hear someone mention it, and I'm like, oh, yeah, I was, like, really, like, interested in, like, watching that. I always forget to put that on my watch list, but I definitely have to, like, look into that. Because, I mean, yeah, like, it sounds fun, and I like, you know, feral Robert Pattinson. That's always a fun time. Going into, like, my picks, I felt so bad because one of my picks is actually, for the good ones anyways, is the first Pirates of the Caribbean, Curse of the Black Pearl, which, you know, I was very young when it came out, but I watched it a lot when I was a kid. I know people besmirch the Pirates, like, franchise, and, you know, the Johnny Depp of it all is uncomfortable, but that first movie is a lot of fun. Like, I will ride for it a lot. I really, really like that movie. People talk about it online all the time. The whole sequence, the skeleton pirate sequence, where they're, like, taking Elizabeth Swann through this, like, floating haunted mansion, and Barbossa hits her with the, like, you best start believing in ghost stories. You're in one. It's cinema. Like, I don't know what else to say. Like, I'm weak for that. I love that stuff. That first one is a really good distillation of like a fun romp, because it's the only one that knows that we need breaks from Jack, and the rest of them kind of all commit that fatal sin where Jack is like our main character most of the time. Not that, you know, Orlando Bloom is he's fine. I don't hate him as much as a lot of people do, but he's a fun time, and I think Keira Knightley's fun in it. I just love that first one. It's just maybe it's the childhood nostalgia, but it's fun. And then my other good one, I just have to shout it out for my older sister, Jumanji. My older sister, she's 10 years older than me. So she was definitely like, a lot of those movies trickle down, and Jumanji is definitely one of them, which I rewatched it in a hotel room recently. That thing is terrifying. It's still terrifying. I'm almost 22 years old. And that is still like, it's something about it is just, I mean, people talk a lot about like movies in the 80s were just so much weirder than anything made for kids now. But the fact that is earnestly just a thing that was made for kids. It's like, you're going to sit down and you're going to lose your mind with how scary this is and just how overwhelming all of it is. Like that scene where the mansion is like flooding and there's like a typhoon or whatever, like was legitimately upsetting. I'm watching this on this like tiny hotel room TV, and I was legitimately just like, my God. But it's just so much fun. Like, it's a classic, but it definitely deserves, like, it's just great. And I love watching Robin Williams and things. Just, he's fun. It's just a fun, again, one of those things where that's less of an adventure where I'd like to live in it, but it's such a fun, like, thrill ride of a thing. And I mean that not in like the Martin Scorsese MCU things are roller coasters type of way, but I mean it in like a legitimate, genuine thing. It's still scary. It's still effective. And I really like it. And then for my two bad picks, one of them, which like came to me in a dream recently that I remembered I even saw it, is Prince of Persia, The Sands of Time, I think is the subtitle for it. Which is the movie that people will make fun of me to this day, because it's the movie that convinced me for a while, that had me duped into believing that Jake Gyllenhaal was not a white man.
Oh no.
That movie came out, I must have been like, what, 10, 11? And the thing is, Prince of Persia. So when they cast Jake Gyllenhaal and he's got like the spray tan and the beard, like the scruff or whatever, I'm thinking like, oh, okay. So he's clearly, and it was only until I was like 15 or 16 that I realized, oh, I was had and bamboozled and hoodwinked.
But Gyllenhaal is such an authentic Persian last name. I'm so like shocked by this.
Just like Arterton and Kingsley. Clearly all Persian.
Oh my God. No. But like, I just remember like I sat down in that theater, and I was a kid who like, going to the theater was like I grew up with like a movie loving household. So I was always very like, movies were an expensive outing, and I was sitting there and I had this, and I remember it so clearly because it was the first time I had this thought of like, I want to leave, which had never happened to me in a movie theater before. And so for that, I just have to like, yeah, it's really bad. It's really boring. It's such nonsense. Like there's a magic knife. And that's all I can really remember, but like, it's just not good. And then my other bad one is, I forget who directed this. I feel like it's somebody that I usually like, Pan.
From Joe Wright. Yes.
Good Lord. What happened? But yes, Pan, which we all had Pan fever. We all had Rooney Mara as Tiger Lily fever.
Right, who was clearly an American Indian. Yep.
Oh my goodness gracious.
Actually, she's Persian. Big shocker.
big twist.
Oh big twist. Featuring Garrett Hedlund as like, you know, a weird Tumblrification, like Captain Hook. That movie is just like, there's snippets of that movie that will come back to me every now and again, where it's just like, yeah, when they introduce Neverland, they introduce it as like slave children mining pixie dust singing Nirvana or something like that. Like it's this weird jukebox musical, but it also just looks so hideous, and the main kid is really bad. And yeah, Peter Pan deserves better. Like, I mean, I also think we should maybe put Peter Pan away for a while just because people keep trying it and it doesn't work. But yeah, Pan is hot mess. Like, it's just, oh man.
Yeah, to quickly speak on yours, I think the first Pirates movie still fucking slaps. I think it's great.
Thank you.
It's just pure entertainment from front to back. Super fun, great score.
Oh my god.
Great characters, good action, battle scenes. Jeffrey Rush fucking crushes it as Barbossa. He's so good. Yeah, I think the first Pirates movie is absolute blast still. Jumanji, I want to say I was like 12 or 13 when that came out, so I don't think it was necessarily for me. And I never really caught on to it. Like, I think it's fun. I think it's fun, but it's not one that I like often think of. But, you know, it's okay. I think the first of the sequel / remakes was actually pretty fun. The Welcome to the Jungle, I thought was pretty fun. The second one of those was lousy, other than Kevin Hart playing old Danny Glover in a young man's body was kind of fun. Barnett, Pan is just dreadful. I mean, it's terrible. I saw it once and I'm hard pressed to remember anything about it. Really weird costuming on Hugh Jackman as well. Like, what was happening there? But then, as far as Prince of Persia goes, Prince of Persia to me is exactly how to not make a video game based movie. Because, hey, all this stuff in the video game was really fun to play. Well, let's just show it to you. And you're going to remember it. Be like, oh, yeah, I remember when I actually got to do that in a game. Well, it's fun when you get to do it. It doesn't translate to a fucking movie with some magical knife and, you know, being able to reverse time and blah, blah, blah. And we also forgot about the great Persian actor Alfred Molina as well.
Oh, my God. Yeah. And all the weird political. I remember, like, the dagger was just really integral to, like, some political intrigue that was going on. I'm like, these are video games. What are you talking about?
Yeah, because it's garbage. It's a garbage movie. And that's definitely one of the first examples I can think of post Pirates where Disney was like, oh, we can just print money making these type of movies. And that was a huge flop.
Yet another failed boys please watch our movies endeavor.
Yep.
Right. The movie that probably convinced them just like, no, we just need to make these Marvel movies. That's what actually gives money.
Keep that Gyllenhaal's number just in case.
Right. Yeah. We got to have him play Spooderman's Mysterio for sure. But yeah, I mean, I echo a lot of the sentiments. Like, I think the first Black Pearl, Pirates of the Caribbean is so great, especially considering I was there for like the lead up where everyone was just so doubting it. Just like, it's based on a ride and Johnny Depp's doing a Keith Richards impression. It'll never work. And it worked so stupendously then that everyone's been chasing that down to like Prince of Persia and so many other movies still to this day are trying to still do that Pirates of the Caribbean magic that not even the sequels for the most part could really recreate. Jumanji, I think, is fun, if nothing else, because the terror kind of works in spite of its kind of, like, weird datedness. Like, those monkeys are terrifying now for a completely different reason than in 95, because those monkeys look horrifying. Those horrible CG monkeys are unnerving, to say the least. But Williams is having fun, and there's a lot of, like, I think it really captured when I was a kid even that sensibility of just, like, oh, what if these creatures were, like, in your house? Like a big spider that could, like, poison you, and you have to, like, try and get past that, or the giant crocodile when everything fills up and shit like that. There's some fun to, like, a lot of those set pieces. Pan, also, that just feels like it's studio notes the movie, of just, like, let's combine all these different drafts together and do all this weird shit, where we'll have, like, the Nirvana thing in the same movie where, like, whenever they go over to Hugh Jackman as the evil pirate captain in his quarters, he's got, like, a breathing mask on, like he's Darth Vader in his fucking egg thing. Just like, I have to survive on the pixie dust.
Yeah, the pixie dust is like crack cocaine or something. It's not well.
Right, he looks like Nosferatu or some shit. Just like, what the fuck are we doing? What is this? And Garrett Hedlund totally doing an Indiana Jones, like, impression. Trying to be like, you know, Disney, if you ever reboot this,
God bless Garrett Hedlund, because he's in so many curse genre things. He's in Aragon, which I don't know if any of you have ever seen.
Yes, I'm aware of Aragon.
My God. And then poor guy, Tron was foisted upon him. It's not his fault, but...
Watch it.
Oh, no, I love that movie, but I'm saying, like, it was, like, it's a cursed endeavor for him because nothing really came of it, you know? Like, it's just that man...
But before we head out of the segment, as we usually do, we like to repeat our titles just to make sure everybody got them. So we'll start and we'll go in the order that we went in previously. Adam, please, your titles, just to repeat them.
For My Good, I had The Mummy with Brendan Fraser, and then I had Excalibur, And for my bad, I had Kangaroo Jack and The Mummy with Tom Cruise.
And then for my two good, I had the original Adventures of Robin Hood from 1938 and The Lost City of Z. And then for my bad, I had Pirates of the Caribbean on Stranger Tides and Almost Heroes.
And then for my good, I had Pirates of the Caribbean, : The Curse of the Black Pearl, and then Jumanji, the original. And then for my bad, I had Prince of Persia, : The Sands of Time, and Pan.
Yes, and submit your titles, please, to us for the double redo, if you have any of them out there in the listenership. But we have some people we want to thank and stuff before we get to our picking for next week. Stay tuned for that. And to thank, we have, of course, Mr. Chris Oliver, who does the intro and outro music for our show. Listen more of his music at chrisoliver.bandcamp.com. Thanks to Christian Thor Lally for our artwork. Follow him at Night of Water. That's Night with a K, _of_water on Twitter to find a link tree and stuff to all his other great artwork. And thanks, of course, to our loyal Patreon supporters, patreon.com/gedbpod, where for just $1 a month, you all get to listen to bonus podcasts we do and vote in polls for topics and movies we cover. And there's a lot of stuff coming out around the time of this episode. This week you get to vote for an upcoming topic we'll be doing for next month between two comedy subgenres. We haven't done as many comedy subgenres as episodes before, so you all get to pick that. It's between your options of dark comedies or mockumentary films. So you all get to vote on that, and whatever you guys choose over there, we end up doing as an episode next month. And then in terms of bonus podcasts, oh boy, there's a lot of stuff for you to listen to. We'll have an On the Edge of Relevance, which is our show where we cover new movies that have recently come out. We'll have two new episodes coming out here, where there's one for the new Steven Soderbergh film on HBO Max, Kimmy, and then another one for the Netflix Texas Chainsaw Massacre that I'm sure you're all so excited about.
Yeah.
Probably on Adam the most, rearing and ready.
So excited. Oh, fuck.
Yes. And then we'll also be having an audio commentary. We do like a monthly podcast where we switch off on something. And this month will be an audio commentary where we're doing Roadhouse, the Patrick Swayze movie that we've always wanted to do for the show, but it always kind of fits in either good or bad territory, and we're never quite sure where to put it. So we're like, fuck it, we'll just talk through the whole movie, because there's so much to say.
And we found a really fun way to do it, which I'm excited about.
Yes, put a pin in that, definitely.
Yeah.
And then also this week, we'll be putting up a little bit of a call to action for all of you Edgelord patrons, as we call you, for you to help us with our upcoming next bonus podcast in March will be a March Madness bracket thing like we did last year, where we talked about the March Madness bracket for movie villains. This time we'll be doing one for the best sequel out there. And as we've done usually, there'll be five people on that panel, and all of us have chosen six particular sequels to do, to put on the bracket, and we're going to seed that. But we need two more slots that you patrons get to fill. So there'll be a post up at the end of the week asking you all, like, hey, what's another sequel we could add besides the ones that are already mentioned? And we'll pick two different ones from all the various comments we would get, and we'll credit you on the actual episode, of course, and it'll be entered in competition. It might win. Who knows? Whatever you might pick might be crowned the best sequel for our March Madness bracket.
Yeah. We did y'all a little dirty last time.
Yes, we'll see. We'll see. But we also want to thank our lovely guest, Hale. Thank you so much for being on the show. Please plug yourself. Where can people find you on the internet?
Yeah, so thanks so much for having me on. I feel like I've probably talked a little bit too much, but thanks so much for dealing with that. Yeah, like Thomas said at the beginning, most of my stuff is on Film Cred, but I also, you know, I'm freelancing, so you can find a lot of my work on like other places, on Fanbyte, on Inverse, things like that. I'm on Twitter at @theshimmer_. So that's all one word, the shimmer, two M's, and then an underscore at the end. And that's where I am yelling about a lot of stuff lately. It's been between Wordle and figure skating at the Olympics, but I'm good now. I'm calm. But yeah, so that's just where you'll find me. Yeah, thanks again so much for having me on. It was a lot of fun.
Never apologize for talking too much. If anything, someone needs to talk over us. We have too much
talk. Oh, God, yes, please.
For the love of God, interrupt us, please. Yes. But for more of us, you can find us on Twitter and Facebook at DEDBpod. And you can also submit feedback to us at our email, doubleedgedoublebill@gmail.com, all spelled out. You can find me on Twitter, Instagram, and Letterboxd @NotTheWhosTommy. And I also do some writing both at marianithomas.wordpress.com and film-cred.com, of course. I also write there. And I also want to shout out over on the Film Cred Patreon. They recently launched a podcast called Film Cred Review, spelled R-E-V-U-E. And I'm not on that show, but I helped produce it. Basically, I was helping to kind of shape what the show is, which essentially our main host, Shay Vassar, gets a guest on to talk about some news items and then an individual topic. This first episode, she had on a friend of the show, Jessica Scott, to discuss the 45th anniversary of Suspiria. And that particular episode is free, so anybody can listen to it. And future episodes will come out every 2 weeks over on the Patreon. And you can listen to it if you sign up for the Patreon for Film Cred for at least just $1. You can listen to further episodes. And I'll be involved in that producerial capacity. I want to help give a voice to others out there. So once again, I don't blather on as I do on the show all the time.
Like you just did. You could find me on Twitter or Instagram at @atom_or_Adam. That's @atom_or_ADAM. Or on Letterboxd at Schwanson. That's SCHWANDTSON.
Yes. And to hear more of our antics, please subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and other podcasting platforms. If you're listening on the Talk Film Society Network, why not listen to all the other great shows on here? And if you've listened to all those, why not dig into our archives and our Podbean main feed for several hours of us blathering before we join Talk Film Society? And if nothing else, if you can't support the show on the Patreon or anything like that, it's totally cool. The completely free way to help us out is to rate, review, or simply share the show around, because that gets us more visibility out there in the algorithms.
Yeah, thanks everybody who's been doing it. We really appreciate it. You know, it helps us a lot. And Christian, go fuck yourself.
Yes, the eternal running joke of disparaging our dear friend Christian. But it's time we finally end the show here with our picking, as we do every week. Each week, Adam and I each have one of us has two good movies, one of us has two bad movies. We switch up on the quality for that, and we assign numbers between 1 and 10 for each of our choices to get the other person or a guest, like Hale, to pick number between 1 and 10 for each of our choices, and whichever one that gets closest to of the person's two picks, that gets us our good, and the same thing for our bad feature. And keep in mind that we do have something else called the Godfather Rule, where Adam and I were each given a single veto at the end of during our last anniversary last May, where we have the option, if we hear one of the choices that we've picked after the number between 1 and 10 is chosen, and we're like, oh, I don't know if we want to really cover that. Actually, I'll take the cannoli, is the magic word we say, and thus we get whatever the alternate choice was. Adam has already had his veto used recently. I still have mine burning a hole in my back pocket. I gotta use before May, before our next anniversary. But I don't know if I'll be using it for next week's topic, which our patrons, patreon.com/GEDBpod, chose for a 70s sort of topic. We ended up with 1977 in film. You know, it's sort of a big year that shaped a lot of cinema to follow. And Adam has the two good choices for that. I have the two bad choices. And Hale, please, for Adam's two good choices, pick a number between 1 and 10.
Sure. I'll pick the number 5.
Alrighty. At number 3, I have the, you know, inarguable classic, Burt Reynolds' Smokey and the Bandit.
Oh, okay. I have seen this one before. I remember not loving it, but at the same time, you know, it could use a revisit. I wouldn't mind seeing maybe if it changes new leaf. So I'm not going to take the cannoli on that.
Fuck. All right. At number 10, I had one of the greatest sci-fi classics of all time, Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Oh, that little gem, of course.
Yeah, you might have heard of it.
Might have heard of it, maybe.
Yeah, you might have.
The biggest sci-fi film of that particular year. No other.
Yeah, it's the one where Richard Dreyfuss plays with potatoes, and I could watch that man play with potatoes for hours.
Yes, of course. Now, Ayo, please, for my two bad choices, pick a number between 1 and 10.
Sure. I'll pick the number 9.
Oh, boy. I'm very excited.
Over
at number 10, I have a movie that, you know, by many standards is bad, but I know Adam and I have watched and are so very entertained by. The star vehicle, I believe the third one at this point, for cinema legend Rudy Ray Moore, I have Petey Wheatstraw, The Devil's Son-in-Law.
Yes! That's a 5 out of 5. Why is that the bad?
Some people might consider it poorly made and ineptly acted, but you know what? We're going to talk about it a lot.
Great.
So much fun.
Yes. Oh, boy.
We're going to have a lot of fun next time. And then over at number 2, I had a genuinely bad one. One that's sort of infamous. I had Exorcist 2, The Heretic.
Oh, fuck me. Oh, good Lord. Thank God. Oh.
Yes.
It's so bland and boring.
Yes.
Is that the one where they venture into the African continent, land of my ancestors?
Yes, and have James Earl Jones in a locust outfit? Yes, indeed.
Yes, that is the one.
Well, no, we're glad we're not doing that. Very glad we're not doing that. But yeah, Petey Wheatstraw and Smokey and the Bandit, next time on the show. That's the kind of fun double feature you get with our show. And it's time to end this particular episode. And until next time, let's go on another rousing adventure. Everybody, onto the ship.
All right, all right, all right. I've been working on that impression for a long time.
Oh, perfect. Oh, my God. It's like Matthew Conn is in the room with us. Oh, take a shower.
Do you guys like to smoke grass?
God.